Greetings, constant listeners. This is Nick Deolius, and you're listening to episode 43 of the Far Middle Podcast. This episode 43 is going to be an emergency Far Middle special edition, unfortunately, because we've got a lot going on in the world right now that I want to cover, and we'll get to that in a minute. First, let me wish everyone out there a happy St. Patrick's Day. It's right around that time of year. I have to be honest with you, St. Patrick's Day is not my most favorite of holidays. In fact, it's probably my least favorite. I should be a huge, I guess, fan of it in that I'm Catholic and I've got a lot of Irish friends in Western Pennsylvania. But I got to tell you, the thought of sort of standing in massive crowds packed together in a bar, drinking of all things green beer and doing it probably on a gray, wet, whether it's snow or rain, March day in sort of the Pittsburgh area doesn't really appeal to me. It never did all that much. But for those that are enjoying this week and St. Patrick's Day, happy St. Patrick's Day to all. On the dedication for episode 43 of the Far Middle, I'm going to go with a pair of football players from two different eras, one from the 70s and one from the 2000s. One is much beloved from my perspective, and one has always played sort of the role of a villain from my perspective, despite having a pretty good career. Both of them wore number 43, and both of them, interestingly, are safeties. Their position of choice was safety on the defensive side of the ball. So on the beloved one, we're going to go with Troy Polamalu of Southern Cal fame and, of course, Pittsburgh Steelers fame. I mean, the best way I could sort of sum up Troy Polamalu was he was an artist on the field. So he was the guy that was capable of highlight plays that sort of defy the laws of nature. You'd see what he did and said, now, how did he do that? And he was very much an artist when it came to playing defense, which is something you don't see much in football. You see that on the offensive side. Perhaps, right? We talked about Gale Sayers in prior episodes and Barry Sanders. But on the defensive side, not so much. Defensive side is more of a brute approach and dominant approach, whereas Troy was much more of an artist. So I think of him much more in respect and relative to some of the offensive players that remind me of him, like Sayers and Sanders. I think of them like a Michael Jordan or a Bo Jackson, just somebody that could really catch your eye. And you were always watching, no matter where he was at on the field or what play was being run at that time. The other good thing about Troy Polamalu, great family man, spiritual man. So good from those perspectives to see an actual bona fide, legitimate person behind what's going on underneath the helmet. And I don't think he was treated all that fairly, I'm sad to say, toward the end of his career by the Steelers. I think that was unfortunate. But it looks like some of those wounds and those missteps are being healed and corrected respectively, and that's good to see. Now, his alter ego that I want to dedicate episode 43 to was a bit of, a villain to me growing up as a kid. That's because he was playing in the 70s, and he played for the Dallas Cowboys, which were a big rival of the Steelers back in the day. And that football player is Cliff Harris, who was also a safety like Troy Polamalu. Now, in Super Bowl X, which was a Super Bowl in Miami in the Orange Bowl, the old Orange Bowl, where the Cowboys and Steelers squared off for the first time. That's the Super Bowl where Lynn Swann was doing his version of art on the football field with just two tremendous catches, acrobatic catches that just have been preserved for time immemorial. There was another incident in that Super Bowl that a lot of people remember, which was, of all things, a field goal attempt. It was a missed field goal by the Steelers. The kicker, Roy Girella, who was the place kicker for the Steelers through their Super Bowl runs in the 70s, he missed a field goal, which he often did, actually. And Cliff Harris sort of patted him on the head after he missed a field goal. Jack Lambert was on that special teams unit at the time, didn't like that. He got into a tussle with Cliff Harris. And, from there on, Cliff Harris, A, because he played for the Cowboys, and B, because of that incident, instantly took the role of villain, at least in my eyes, from there forward. One statistic that might sort of put things in perspective on how much things have changed when it comes to sports and business and just the overall state of society. Super Bowl X was in 1976. A 30-second commercial spot cost you $110,000 for Super Bowl X. This year's Super Bowl, 30-second commercial, $7 million. So a 30-second commercial spot in Super Bowl X in 1976 went from $110,000 then to $7 million this year. Boy, how things can change quickly on you. So joint dedication, episode 43, Troy Polamalu, Cliff Harris, two safeties from the football field of profession. And as I said, this is an emergency special edition of the Far Middle. We want to dedicate this to cover all the issues and some thoughts surrounding Russia-Ukraine. We told you so. We talked about this in prior episodes of the Far Middle. And unfortunately, now here we are sitting in the middle of this as it's all actually happening. And I think the reactions and the actions across various entities and groups and leaders, I think they've all been true to form. We've learned an awful lot, really confirmed, I think, is the more appropriate term, an awful lot about what we had suspected, good and bad. And I'm going to start with the good. I'm going to start with the Ukrainians because they have demonstrated tremendous, and I don't want to use an inappropriate term here, so I'll try to be more diplomatic. They've exerted and demonstrated tremendous courage and guts. Let's leave it at that. And boy, what an illustration of leadership. First, you know, start with the president, start at the very top, President Zelensky. This guy is amazing. Some of his sound bites and his quotes, they'll be preserved forever. I mean, the one, of course, "I don't need a ride, I need ammo." How classic was that? When he was addressing some leaders from Europe, he was on a video conference basically saying, "This might be the last time you see me alive." I think that resonated and struck a chord with a lot of people in that conference center or conference room, to where they were in a position to help develop the leadership positions of what some of these European countries are going to do with respect to supporting the Ukraine. And then the other quote he had that's not as popular or well-known as those first two, I think was very telling too, very impactful. He said, "I don't read off the sheet because the paper phase in the life of my country has ended." You know, that to me is a great summation of how so much today of what we see in this world that's actually going wrong or that's screwed up is because in the end, it's based off of some fiction or some ideal or ideology that looks good or might sound good. But when you think it through and when you try to apply it in the harsh reality of the real world, it completely falls apart. I think his quote, President Zelensky's quote on that topic, really is a great summation of it. This guy is basically our modern day Winston Churchill. And I think we all learn something from just paying closer attention to that individual as best we can. Then beyond, you know, the mayor, I'm sorry, beyond the president of Ukraine, you got the mayor of Kiev, the capital or Kyiv. And of course, that is Vitali Klitschko of boxing fame. I mean, I basically watched him in the ring many times along with his brother, great boxers. And he becomes mayor of the capital. And what's he doing? He's walking around the city with a machine gun and he's not leaving the city. So you talk about standing tall. Klitschko, Mayor Klitschko, is doing just an outstanding job from my perspective. And then I'm not sure if you guys had come across this or not, but there is a lady who is an MP in parliament in the Ukraine. There's a picture of her going around. She's in her apartment or her flat, basically hoisting an automatic weapon ready to go. The best way I can sum these individuals up and the Ukrainians up are heroes. And I have to tell you, my mind continually, every time I see some of these examples and read some of these quotes and see this type of leadership, my mind keeps going back to imagining if the Ukraine were the United States, or the corollary, if the United States were in the same shoes right now that the Ukraine is in, how different might things be with respect to our leaders? So I think of people like ex-Mayor de Blasio from New York City. What would he do if New York was being encircled by forces looking to do it harm or to destroy it? Would he stand tall? How about those mayors out on the West Coast from Los Angeles and San Francisco? You know, those are the ones that were caught without masks at the Super Bowl, taking selfies with Magic Johnson, saying that they were holding their breath when they were taking their photos. You think they'd stand tall? How do you think they would hold up during a crisis like that if their cities were threatened in similar ways that Ukrainian cities are being threatened? And then I think about all those elites down in Washington, D.C. You know, if they were offered a quick evacuation, a quick ride out of the country, would they take it at the first chance, or would they say no and stand and lead? And then I think about our celebrities, whether they're, you know, TV or movie, music or sports. So your baseball stars or your basketball stars or your movie stars, would they be walking around with rifles to defend their city or their hometown? As one quote unquote leader, and I use that term loosely, likes to say from our country, "Come on, man." Now, we have the lady on The View, right, who's talking about how this war was going to disrupt the vacation that she was planning to Italy. And we've got colleges and universities that they continually talk about triggering aggressions. And they're talking about triggering aggressions to the most coddled students in the history of the world, while we've got students in the Ukraine who got their fingers on actual triggers out of necessity. What a contrast. And then, of course, there's the United Nations. And this was going to be an opportunity to see, you know, whether the United Nations was going to actually be a leader in the interest of the good, or once again, you know, double down on things, positions, and policies that have enabled the bad. And of course, and unfortunately, we saw that it was the latter. So the United Nations was sensing that people were starting to figure out that climate change policy has been a massive, perhaps the key enabler of people like Putin to be able to do what they do. So what does the United Nations do? They don't adjust. They don't adjust their positions on things like climate change policies to stop enabling. What they do is they double down. They ramp up their ideological campaign and their disinformation campaign. So the United Nations puts out a report, and they put out this report literally as Russian troops are rolling across the border into Ukraine, killing Ukrainians. So this is when you can cue the dramatic music and the imagery, right? Because this is basically a Hollywood production to paint quite the colorful picture of what's going on here. But you've got these words and these phrases that are in the new UN report that came out a couple of weeks ago. You've got words like direst, emergency, critical, widespread, pervasive, far-reaching, and my favorite, this is a new one, graphic compelling evidence. Got to remember that term, graphic compelling evidence. And what you see here is, as I said, quite a display, a pathetic display of placing things like virtue signaling, placing the ability to grab more power for entities like the United Nations or those supporting it via climate change policies, putting those things in front of the human condition. And we've talked about how climate change policies hurt the human condition of the developed world, i.e. the middle class, small businesses, etc. We talked about how climate change policies hurt the human condition in the developing world, where you've got a couple billion people living in abject poverty. They don't have access to reliable, affordable energy and electricity, and climate change policies are deterring the time when they would receive those types of access points. But now we're seeing how climate change policies are hurting the human condition in situations in the here and now, literally life and death when it comes to Ukraine and Russia, because these climate change policies have been to the direct benefit of entities like Russia and people like Vladimir Putin. And they figured out that not just has it been a financial boon to them, it's also been a geopolitical leverage point. And now they're making, you know, full utilization of that leverage via what's going on with Ukraine. No, and then you've got, you know, the sanctions that we've seen in the United States. And to me, these sanctions and the whole journey on sanctions since Russia invaded Ukraine has really sort of exposed an unwillingness to take action to stop Russia. Not just an unwillingness, and what I fear is perhaps an inability to take action to stop Russia. So what we focus on and what the media keeps harping upon is the superficial. We're touting all these actions, which are largely superficial in nature. You got things like Netflix that has stepped up and won't air state Russian media. Okay, so, all right, you can't stream Russian state media via Netflix, so I guess good for Netflix. But is that really going to change anything with respect to what's going on and decision-making by the powers that be, specifically with entities like Russia or China? I doubt it. You also got big tech, social media. I found this to be pretty interesting. You know, you had a prior president that opened his mouth and he got banned from social media. But then you've got Russia that basically had to invade a country before they got banned by social media and big tech. I mean, it's just amazing how inconsistent and late to the game things like big tech, social media has been, and just how sort of superficial the actions have been. You've got the Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, that just wrapped up, of course, as we discussed in a prior episode of The Far Middle, the Genocide Games in Beijing. But now they are riding on their high morality horse by banning Russian athletes for world competition. Unfortunately, it took them a week to get there after the invasion because, once again, a little bit of an inability, unwillingness, spineless approach to what they're doing. And then I saw that the World Curling Federation, you know, curling's that sport that you see in the Winter Olympics where they're scrubbing the ice to try to get this disc, right, to a target. But the World Curling Federation has banned Russia. I'm sure that's going to hurt And I'm sure that's going to absolutely change what Vladimir Putin is deciding to do or not do in the coming weeks. In the media and our government, they are touting how these sanctions were overwhelming and unprecedented. Yet for weeks, right, we're struggling with having entities like Rosneft and Gazprom not even being targeted. Those two entities are the largest taxpayers to the Russian government. They are also the largest employers in Russia. These giants are extensions of the Russian state. So if you're at war with Russia, you're going to have to hit entities like Rosneft and Gazprom, not just Russian soccer teams. So why aren't we sanctioning, or why do we struggle to sanction these giants? Well, I mean, one reason is inflation. It's now a problem. But really, the bigger reason is that sanctions on things like Russian energy, it's going to highlight the importance and the need of domestic oil and natural gas industries in the United States. And that, of course, goes against the climate change religion of academia, of the bureaucratic state, of global institutions like the UN and the like. So, you know, sacrifice the Ukraine and all those innocent lives in the Ukraine by letting the slaughter continue, as long as we don't expose, right, the zero carbon myth, that's going to be an exchange that's well worth it in the eyes of the left and in the eyes of these elite entities that I just mentioned when it comes to climate change, religion, and the ideology that goes with it. And worse yet, of course, right, the strife causes commodity prices to rise more. That means a bigger benefit to the Russian state. And as it continues to export and sell to the West, you got oil that, I mean, it changes by the day, but, you know, it ran through $100 a barrel, then through $130 a barrel, 8-year highs, highest since 1990. Just shame across the board. And by the way, these unprecedented sanctions that the West pats its own back on, they don't impact the banks that service the Russian energy industry either. So all that talk about the SWIFT sanctions for the payment system for banks, the SWIFT system, that excluded, right, initially the energy banks. So that's going to exclude entities like Gazprom Bank, and untouched by these unprecedented sanctions are basically the entire infrastructure, the entire economic ecosystem of all things related to energy and commodity, which is basically the Russian economy itself. And one more, oh, by the way, the U.S. and the West was also not sanctioning Russian mineral and commodity giants like Nornickel. Now, why? That's because Nornickel produces about 5% of the world's nickel, along with a bunch of cobalt and copper. All of those are needed for smartphones and for electric vehicles. This is another example of how climate change policies and environmentalism, they fund oppression and they fund entities like Putin. And by the way, they increase CO2 when you look at things on a scopes 1 through 3 cumulative basis. Isn't very sustainable, is it? If energy supply is cut from Russia, by the way, there's another harsh reality, sort of the physics coming to bear. If we cut energy supply from Russia, there is going to be energy rationing in Europe. And there is going to be things like rampant inflation in the United States. And the root cause is not what you're hearing about. It's not what the media and news entities and the administration in the United States is pointing to. It's not the Russian invasion. The Russian invasion is not the root cause. The Russian invasion is a first derivative symptom. So just like U.S. inflation and EU energy rationing, that would be a second derivative symptom. The root cause, when you start unpeeling the onion, the root cause is climate change policies that created and enabled this situation. Zero carbon fantasy made Putin the problem that he is. Now, on the good side, sort of, is Germany. Germany is actually stepping up, which I guess is amazing in and of itself. It is now pledging over 2% of its GDP to defense spending, and it's now allowing military aid to fly over its airspace, which it didn't initially allow when it came to supporting Ukraine. So I got a couple of thoughts with Germany. First, you know, the idea was to deter war, not to do these things in response to a war that allowed to start, or you helped allow to start, due to weakness. So in some ways, I guess the horse has left the barn, and now Germany is in a bit of a reactionary mode. And the other thing I'm thinking about with Germany, didn't the prior president in the United States criticize Germany for not spending enough on defense? Now, how come we don't see those old news stories, op-eds, or video clips anymore? So our prior president, was he a loudmouth? Yep. Was he crass? Yep. But he was also right on this topic, at least, all along. And NATO now, right, they're asking for 2% of GDP for NATO members to be invested into defense. Germany was way below that. I think it was around 1.5% of GDP. Now, after the invasion of Ukraine, it speaks of being over, or targeting of being over 2% of GDP. So better late than never, at least I hope. And let's not stop with Germany. Let's take a geopolitical tour of how nations are reacting to this situation across the globe. Poland. Poland has always lived in a tough neighborhood with some pretty scary neighbors. It wasn't just Germany that invaded Poland when World War II kicked off. It was also Russia. So Poland's not shy about helping the Ukraine. It doesn't worry about the optics of aid and military support. Poland's a land route into Ukraine for aid and military hardware. In a lot of ways, because countries like our own are too timid to step foot or fly a foot into Ukraine to help. Similar to Poland is Finland. The Finns are 1/8 the population of the Ukraine, so much smaller in population. And they also, like Poland, they've got a nasty history with Russia going back to World War II when Russia tried to invade Finland in 1939. So now they're sending arms to the Ukraine and they're debating about joining NATO. I don't think they're going to join NATO, and they certainly won't join NATO if Sweden doesn't join with them. They'll come in as a duo if they decide to do so. But it does show how a small country like Finland, with a massively long border with Russia, they'll step up to help Ukraine more than the most powerful nation on earth will. Switzerland, so the Swiss of all people, they are also not sitting on their hands and remaining neutral, which is something you don't see every day or with every conflict when it comes to Switzerland. The Swiss agreed to enforce EU sanctions on targeted Russians and their assets, which was good to see. Another surprise was Cyprus, because Cyprus, as many of you know, that's a Russian asset haven, but it's also with the EU, and so is Japan. And that matters because of the yen being a safe haven currency. The Japanese know what China will be tempted to do in the Pacific and with Taiwan if Putin's allowed to roam loose. So Japan sees a direct corollary between what's going to happen with Russia and whether they're successful or not, and what China decides to do in Japan's backyard, so to speak. And in Turkey, you know, they've been an odd study for me in all of this. Russia does worry them. There's a historic rivalry with Russia, and they've got the right and the ability, Turkey does, to close the Bosporus Straits in times of war, which would cut off Russian ships to the Mediterranean. So that could be a key maneuver or a key tactic to apply. But so far, no go with the always hard-to-read Erdogan. He's just a tough guy to read when it comes to what his next move is going to be. India has been, I think, the biggest disappointment to me outside of the United States. They are on the sidelines, but like Japan, they should fear what a rewarded Russia would do in setting an example for an aggressive China. India is, in fact, worse than Japan and not even on the sidelines, because I think they abstained from voting for a UN declaration against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And of course, India and China are squaring off in brutal fighting up in the Himalayas on that border, that disputed border. Israel has been very tough to read, sort of middle of the road, I guess a bit of a disappointment. They have offered to mediate, but of course, I think they should take a stronger stance. But you know, you look from Israel's perspective with the sort of lukewarm embracing from the United States with its policies, it's probably trying to figure out which way the winds are blowing before they commit one way or another in their own self-interest. Iran benefited from all this and is benefiting from all this. That adds insult to injury, certainly. The United States knows it looks weak on how it deals with allowing Russia to roll into the Ukraine. The Biden administration knows it looks bad when it talks about assuming leadership in the world again, post the prior president, and then Putin pokes us in the eye and starts a war where none existed prior to the Biden administration. And U.S. politicians in power know that climate policies and geopolitical bungling are strangling Americans with inflation and supply chain woes. So what do our leaders do in response to all of that? They cave to one of the worst regimes on the planet and allow it to march towards nuclear capabilities, allow it to sell its oil to prop up its economy, and allow it to gain credibility. Pretty shameful, but I guess beneficial from Iran's perspective. And more shameful is how the United States is bowing down to Venezuela, another despotic regime trampling all over human rights. But like Iran and Russia, the United States needs its oil if it's going to allow climate change zealotry to kill domestic energy here. So now we go to Venezuela, we send our diplomatic emissaries to beg for oil and let that regime get back into the global oil market. And then China, well, I can sum it up with a quote with Washington being named by China as the culprit of current tensions surrounding Ukraine. That was the official Chinese position. Really? Look, I've seen the enemy constant, listeners, but more on China in a few minutes. And maybe we should just talk about China now, but really, the reason I want to link China here, I want to link China and Russia together. I think that it's a mistake to look at them separately when it comes to what's going on with all the positioning with invasion of Ukraine and all the fallout that occurs. The war with the Ukraine is going to bring China and Russia closer together, and it's exposing effectively an alliance that was already underway. And the recent summit before, during the Olympics in Beijing declared what was the term, no limits to the relationship. For sure, Ukraine does put China in some ways in a tough spot, but the alliance is going to remain. In fact, I think both countries will be forced to double down on their commitment to each because of the war in the Ukraine. So Russia, over the long term, when you look at things economically or strategically, becomes the cornfield and the gas station for China. And long term, Russia and China are going to do what they've always done, which is first and foremost, they're going to support and push and lobby for climate and energy policies in the West that surrenders the West's energy independence to entities like China and Russia. That's the big picture, which is let's use things like zero carbon concepts, the zero carbon economy, the Code Red for Humanity, climate change policies. And in the end, what we're doing here is geopolitically, we're taking what was a huge strategic lever for the West, which was energy independence, and we're going to surrender that and exchange it for energy dependence, but more importantly, dependence on those very same states that are creating the policy, which is entities like China and Russia. Just look at some of the statistics to put this in perspective. Up until 2010, right? So just right at about the time when climate change policies and this virtue signaling really took hold, the EU produced more natural gas than Russia exported. Now, over the past 12 years since 2010, things reversed, and now Russian exports, of course, easily exceed EU natural gas production by a factor of 3 to 1. So you can see what the impact of climate change policies have done. It basically traded energy independence from the perspective of the EU versus Russia to energy dependence, and the utilization of natural gas hasn't changed. Russia and China, they're going to use that energy leverage to press war or geopolitics, not just with respect to Ukraine, but also with all of Eastern Europe, with Taiwan, with the South China Sea, and with the entire Pacific Basin. Things are going to get much worse before they get better. The single biggest conclusion, learning of this whole situation with Russia-Ukraine, is being able to separate the symptoms from the root cause madness. The root cause madness is not the tin-eyed despot in Moscow. He's a Frankenstein of a symptom that is coming from the core root cause madness. The core root cause here is the West's climate change policies and those who are shoving them down our throats. They and those created the mess. They and those enabled the madmen. They and those are the ones with blood on their hands. If you stop the climate change policies and those that keep pushing them, then you fix the problem. If you allow these climate change policies that are not based on fact, but instead are based on fiction and ideology, if you allow them to continue, things are going to get worse, and unfortunately, there's going to be more blood. I want to conclude this episode with a happy birthday note. We're going to have more to say about Ukraine, Russia, particularly with respect to what we're seeing within our own country here in the United States on episode 44 next week. But in the interest of time, I want to give a wrap to episode 43. Unfortunately, I don't think the Ukrainian situation is going away anytime soon. And I want to wrap with a happy birthday, March birthday wish to James Madison, one of our founding fathers, probably the singular biggest leader or driver of what the Constitution ended up being. Of course, fourth president of the United States, co-author of the Federalist Papers, along with John Jay and Alexander Hamilton. Give a read to the Federalist Papers. They're awesome writings. And if you want to get a feel for sort of the background research or the source documents that the Constitution was based off of, the Federalist Papers, that's the mother lode of where everything sprung from. He oversaw, as Secretary of State under Jefferson, the Louisiana Purchase. That turned out pretty well for the United States. Of course, he was president during the War of 1812. Interesting thing about James Madison, he never weighed more than 100 pounds. So he wasn't the largest of men, but with respect to some of the policies and work product and leadership that he exerted in a very interesting body of work and career, to say the least. I want you guys to stay positive and stay strong over the next week. These are trying times. I do believe and I do fear, unfortunately, that things are going to get worse before they get better. But in the long run, you know, if we stick to the core values of what this country and what our economy is based upon and what individual rights are based upon, we will prevail because it is the better road. I'll talk to you next week with episode 44. Until then, stay good, stay safe.